recording. Andy just asked me, when I talk about, as I did yesterday, about giants in the land, are we talking about these as a reality outside our individual and collective psyche? Is that a fair summary of the question?
Yeah. Yes, I, they're both, right? So what we're looking at, in a certain sense, is the what is experienced and envisaged as giants, is the perception of so it's it comes back to the idea of everything being alive, right? So all matter having a certain degree of sentience, and the so when the ancients are looking at the at the living quality of the universe, that gets envisaged and personified. So you get the spirit of a stream, the nymph of a stream, or you get these great figures like the Poseidon, the lord of the oceans, is a personified intelligence of the oceans. And with giants, what's being perceived there are these. Are these slow-moving ancient energies that are a bit like they're a bit like the consciousness of the continental plates shifting. But what you're also looking at is the and in a mythical text like this, what you're looking at is the interaction of human consciousness. If you like, the animate universe. So you also look at how do we relate to that? So we have then reflections within us of these kind of energies. So that sense of the giants being in our bones, the prunes talking about yesterday, is that sort of like mineral aspect of ourselves almost. You know, it's a part of us that is when we talk about these gigantic kind of figures, we're talking about these slow-moving, deep energies that everything else kind of relies upon. And the dispossession, and all the different world mythologies have this thing of you, the newer gods or the newer presences have to push aside or kill or bind or do something with these deep kind of ancient kind of powers in order for a different form of consciousness to arise. So if you think of Greek myths, one of the great things of Greek myths before the gods of Olympus, of Zeus and Hera and Athena and Hermes, the ones that we are most commonly know, there are these gods that are literally called titans. They are these titanic kind of powers, and they are these kind of slow moving. So Britain is supposed to be connected with the titan Cronus, who sleeps deep down under the earth, and whose dreams percolate up through all the strata, and the and in a certain sense the giants are the children of Cronus in this land. Now we also, because we're kind of, if you like, fractal beings who are also connected, so we also have our own connection to that those deep down slow moving kind of energies, which have to give way in a certain sense. Right, to, in order for consciousness to arise, in order for different set of possibilities. Now, the thing about the titanic energies, they're of course deeply connected into the roots of everything, but they can only move very, very slowly. You know, because they are limited by the fact that they are. This slow-moving mineral kind of consciousness. You spend time hanging out with a stone and listen to a stone and let your consciousness interact with the stone. It's quite beautiful. But what happens is you slow down. you get very stable when you relate to the quality of stone. The deeper down you go, as well, is you come eventually down into that place where the stone is a great container of titanic bound energy. So if we go down into the earth far enough, what we find is we find a lot of stability, but then we find movement. We find molten rock. We find molten iron. If we go right down, we find an iron crystal. That is, so that actually, so the core of the earth is one iron crystal that's kind of under enormous pressure and heat. That's like a sort of a miniature sun. And what the titanic energies do is they sort of, in their slow movement, is to act as filters that enables life to manifest. So when those filters aren't there, so if you think of volcanoes, there's where, if you like, that those containing energies are broken. What happens is you get that deep down energy that's supposed to operate in the depth to warm the, you know, without the, because there's two sources of warmth for the life on Earth. It's obviously the sun majorly, but also the warmth and the that's coming out from the sense of the earth, and also the sense of gravity that also manifests out of the sense of the earth that keeps us in our place. Now, when you get a breach in the kind of in the earth's mantle, what you get is volcanic eruption. So that pressure, instead of being contained and helping life on earth to function, suddenly explodes out. And then you're in a landscape where, I don't know if you've ever been to a volcanic landscape, you know, I was being in Etna some years back. And it's an extraordinary landscape because it's sort of, it's this black stuff, you know, and if you see programs about Pompeii, you just see the way in which it covers that kind of incredibly hot ash, buries everything, and there's no, and it's an extraordinary stuff, volcanic ash, because it kills everything. Yet, give it enough time, when it gets broken down by the elements, it's incredibly fertile. So there's a whole kind of mystery here, really. So I think the important thing about the giants, I think, is that yes, they are outsiders and within us. They're, of course, not literal. And so I don't really think there are literal giants pushing things around. But I think when we tune into the level of consciousness, the way the kind of medieval writers had of thinking about this was all these are giants pushing stuff around. We would not probably experience. So when I let my awareness go right down into the earth, and really to tap into those kind of levels, what I experience is this great slow kind of movement. And it's like kind of a slow pulsing. It's hard to get into. It's like it would push me, it sort of pushes me out a bit. So it's not easy to access. So, 'cause I've got to sort of match my resonance with it. But if I do match my resonance with it, then I'm with a sense of deep time. Deep time and slow movement in space. But what happens to me as I do that? So if I, in order to do that, it's like I have to contact the kind of, you know, so sense of Ian just sitting here. I have to relax into that kind of sense of myself as an outgrowth of the world, as a son of Gaia. And to travel into, you know, my own connection to ancestry, to place, to, you know, breath and body, you know, and sort of almost drop down. We'll perhaps do this exercise a bit later on today, and drop down into the kind of the deep. And if I keep going down, As I say, you touch this kind of level where you come into that kind of a sense of the earth's mantle and these great energies moving around. And in the process of doing that, you also come across, before you get to the molten bit, you also discover that threaded through the crust is all these underground rivers and sources of water. So you find, so in a certain sense, you're finding and exploring the solidity of Earth, the fluidity, the water within the Earth. You're coming, and then you're coming down really into this sense of heat and energy and ultimately light, right at the heart of things. And so we would conceptualize these things really differently, because we would think of them now as forces. The important art though is to understand that these are living forces and living beings who will present themselves. They may use old forms, or they may present themselves in completely other forms. So the and in a way, the particular role of the human being, when Kabbalah and other places talk about the human being as being built in the image of the divine, and human beings are these kind of composite beings. Really, so angels are just angels. One of the things, if you come across angels, they know what they're about. There was what was that great film about angels with the killing angel in it? Remember?
You were going to look at me.
Yeah, well, we watched it a couple of times. There was a great film. Yeah.
Him with them.
Can't remember what it was called. There was a brilliant film about angels.
Two archangels that. But they were wicked. Archangels.
Well, they weren't exactly wicked, Alan Rickman was in it.
Alan Rickman was one.
And the story was, there was some loophole whereby they got chucked out.
Dogman.
Dogman.
Well done, Phil.
That's it. It's an absolutely brilliant film about angels, because it it shows you the beauty of angels and the limitation of angels. Now, one of the angels involved is a sort of an angel of righteousness and of wrath. Alan Rickman is Metatron. Alan Rickman is absolutely brilliant in this, because there's this sort of loophole in that somehow that means that people who are escaping, who shouldn't escape, and the angels are trying to plug this, and Alan Rickman, who is Metatron, the highest of the angels, and the principal character is an American woman. He appears at the end of her bed in all his angelic glory, and I am Metatron, the voice of the Most High, and and she's looking at him with a cup of coffee. What? And she does, what? And he does, oh, for God's sake. For God's sake, what's the point of being Metatron if nobody even knows who I am anymore? He sits down the end of the bed a bit depressed and sort of kind of no point putting out my angelic glory. You people don't even know. But one of the interesting figures is this angel of wrath in the book, because he, if anybody blasphemes in front of him, so if you say Jesus, as a kind of a swear word, he then has to kill them, because his message, because they, oh no, they've committed a blasphemy, I have to kill you. Because the angels are like sort of pre-programmed, they have a task, one thing they do. Archangels are a bit less bound by that, but even so, they have a kind of, when we invite the four holy archangels in, they have their very distinct kinds of areas of functioning. Well, then they don't trespass on that, because that's the nature of their being.
Jobsworth.
Well, they literally are Jobsworth. This is my job. It's completely. Whereas human beings are these living bridges between opposites, between different qualities, between the infinite and the particular. So in that, as we kind of inhabit, if you like, the kind of So if we think of, you know, we think of ourselves as human beings as we're really, if we're really present, we're present to our own, if you like, our own transcendental nature, our own soul nature. We're present also to our own personal life and personality and who we are and how we live and all the personal connections. We're present also to the life of Gaia, which is kind of what we're talking about now. We're also present to the human archetypal collective. So in a certain sense, we are this composite sort of being. So when the, interestingly enough, you find this in the beginning of this word Anoki, and its Egyptian roots, where you have this idea of the shining sea of infinity, of the particular nature of the flowering reed, but you also have this sense of being the cup that is woven together. So, you put those together, the human being, the I amness of the human being, is woven out of our sense of infinity, being us being infinite, us the reed being we are particular, we are the particular flowing reed, but also our nature is to weave energies together so that they can be held. So when we're coming to, so when we're looking then at the giants or anything else that's personified, really, we're looking at things that are have a reflection within us and are also in the universe, and our awareness, our ability to perceive and make contact with these beings on whatever scale, is a part of the human function, to be the living bridge and the living witness. And I mean, almost that's the fundamental, the act of becoming present and being the witness is also, in a certain sense, the fundamental human gesture. But it also is where being a human being is a confusing thing to be. Right, so this sense, because one of the struggles I think we have as human beings is the conflict between complexity and simplicity, between one thing and another thing, and in a way the sense of being of, we think of the great archangels, or the cosmic energies. We kind of stand at the center points. So we've got the four angels, we've got Seraphiel, the weaving angel, and we are the center point that brings all this together. And it's why, it's odd how these things work out in unlikely places. In the film Dogma, that's why in order for the world to be set right, it needs a human being to help the angels to sort out this loophole that's going wrong. Another great film about nature of angels is the film Michael, which is about the Archangel Michael, who gets incarnated somehow, I can't remember how, and he creates absolute chaos, because part of Michael's role is to be the warrior of heaven, and so he goes around picking fights all the time and enjoying the battle because he is this fiery being of light who is behaving true to his nature. Now archangels are these absolutely awesome beings who understand much more than we will ever understand about the nature of things. But they're limited within their sphere of influence. In C.S. Lewis's science fiction trilogy, the book called Voyage to Venus, or something like Perelandra, he imagines himself the narrator. Great series of books, this, actually. It's the three books, one called Out of the Silent Planet, second is either called Perelandra or Voyage to Venus, third one is called That Hideous Strength. They're a really great read. And right at the heart of them is a figure called Ransom, who is based upon Tolkien, because he's a philologist and there's a way in which C.S. Lewis borrows some of Tolkien's mythology into it. But the second and the very way it's a very easy read, but also a very profound read, really, because it looks at the nature of evil. It looks at the and one of the things, and it's he's using Christian mythology as his, you know, as his backdrop to it, because he's a convinced Christian, of course, C.S. Lewis. But in the second book, where he's in Venus, he's looking at the possibility, thinking of Venus as a planet that can support life. Not obviously, we know it can't, but he's imagining it can, and seeing it as a new Eden, as a new kind of start. And there's a whole dialogue in that book about the opposing angel, the Lucifer presence, I suppose, trying to tempt the new Adam and Eve to. In particular, tempt new Adam, because in the structure of how he imagines Venus, it is full of all these floating islands, and the particular temptation that's offered to them is to find a way to make the islands fixed, so you can build properly on them, rather than to be fluid, and the sort of the if you like the divine voice that's whispering to the new Adam and Eve, is to not be fixed, is to go with the flow in a certain sense. It's a happy ending story, so the tempter, Sir Ransom, triumphs over the incarnation of the evil figure who kind of... But there's a powerful bit right at the end, but because they refuse the temptation, the great angels kind of come and present themselves to them. And, hi Marcus, come in. Mm-hmm. We're just talking before starting properly. Really. And the angels need Ransom's help to see, well, how should we present ourselves to this new human being? If we don't know how... They're also, you hear the angels talking among themselves, well, what a strange creature a human being is. There is in them such enormous light, yet mingled in with that light are thoughts, which if I thought them, says the angel, my light would go out in a moment. And then you see this thing where they try out different shapes, so there's one sort of interlocking geometries that makes Ransom feel sick. And then there's a rather strange thing of interlocking circles that just... don't disturb him quite as much, but do make him feel a bit weird and queasy, and doesn't really mean anything to him. And then there's a way in which they're led to present themselves as idealized human figures, so they're more relatable. And in a way, it's a really good imagery for when we encounter these deep energies of the earth and the cosmos. So when we invite the angels in here, they have a particular shape, a particular flavor, traditional shape, you know, than describing. But often they can be experienced, often experienced as geometric forms or shapes of light or just presences. And in a way, when we're reading these old mythic books, particularly medieval books, we've got to remember that what we're looking at is the medieval cosmos. And they're helpful to us because they give us an understanding of the way these things are seen at different times. But how we will experience them is in our own direct experience. So we're very unlikely to see giants pushing things around. Just talking about the nature of giants and all that. So what we're not, but so certainly when I tap into those levels, my sense is of these great, sentient, slow-moving processes. And if I sort of let myself match it, which is interesting, my shoulders, one thing, just start to drop. I'm animated, my energy's up. So my energy just starts to drop. I start to come into something much slower, much deeper. I start to start to be able to feel the rootedness in me. That said, just because I'm a creature of the earth, it isn't to do with my identity as a human being, particularly, and nothing to do with my identity as a Welshman or my own personal kind of history. So I'm listening and being with from that gigantic, titanic kind of consciousness. And I'm a medieval person, so I'm listening to the dreams of Cronus. Now, so this sense of perception is also, this is what's meant by imagination as an art of perception. So very easily we say, well, that's just imagination, isn't it? You're just imagining yourself dropping down. Well, the problem is we've learned to think of the imagination as something literally fanciful. And in a way, this is the kind of thing that the Romantic poets, in Coleridge and Wordsworth in particular, were addressing. And Blake also, when Blake talks about Jesus as the imagination made flesh. So the poets who were addressing the 18th century were addressing this great shift of human consciousness into something much more mechanized and split really between that much more holistic way of being and this more industrial dominion based colonial consciousness that is developing with human beings. Coleridge is particularly helpful in this, really, because in his work Biographia Letteraria, he addresses very directly the nature of the imagination. And he says this amazing thing, that the imagination is the repetition within the human consciousness of the creative act, of the creative I am within the divine consciousness. And he talks about two levels of the imagination. He talks about the primary level of the imagination, which is simply perception. So that sense, and it's very interesting this, because it links in with some of the quantum physics idea. The idea that perception is in itself an energy of creation. And when we have quantum physicists telling us that when you measure, that i.e. when you perceive something, you alter its state. Now this is what Coleridge doesn't have the mathematics or the tools to describe that, but when he says primary imagination is perception, what he is describing is that as we perceive something, we come into conversation with it. And that the sense of the universe being maintained by a series of multi-leveled conversations. Now when you look at the nature of reality, you find it described in some ways much more clearly in some of the Eastern traditions, where they talk about the idea of Maya, the idea of illusion, the idea of everything in flux and flow. Where that differs a bit from the kind of Western traditions is they would say, oh, this is all wrong, you've got to get out of it into the place that is solid. Whereas the Western tradition and the Christian and Hermetic tradition in particular would say, no, this is the nature of things which we enter into and participate within as an incarnate being. I enter into the multi-leveled conversation. That's a very old idea, this. So you can go back as far as the pre-Socratic philosopher Parmenides, who says that the deep nature of the universe is a stillness and an exchange of bright colour. Now the stillness is that place that we come to, that I am place that we come to, And the exchange of deep or bright colour is the conversations. And the conversation begins in the act of mutual perception. As I perceive the candle and its flame, and if I relax my filters, I start to feel an affection for the candle. I start to feel the unfathomable nature of the candle and the flame. And in the same way, I start to touch my own unfathomable nature. And so together we enter into mystery. Now, as we let ourselves enter into these conversations, what happens is other images arise, the secondary images, which are part of that conversation. And if we allow that, so as I, just try and track what I'm doing, just try and explain. So what starts to happen as I'm with me and the candle and the, touching the unfathomable nature of the candle, there is a moment of temptation, because then there's images of candles and images of me, feel like images through time of me having other candles here, other versions of the candle, when I got bought this candle. So I can separate from this candle and the conversation and go into what Coleridge would call fancy, which would be to follow the chain of associations in my mind, which then takes me out of the conversation into the more enclosed nature of being me. But if I stay with it, for me right now, one of the images that arises that is connected to the conversation is a sense of the fire right at the heart of everything. So the fire at the center, the flame at the center of the circle, the fire at the heart of the earth, fire of the sun in the heart of the solar system, and then the sense of the great field of stars, and then the mystery that holds all that, as the candle holds the flame. And that can take me somewhere slightly different, where then it can take me into the kind of sense of the nature of wax. So, and these secondary images are doorways into other places. I'm not going to do that now because it would take me too far away from that. So actually, I come back to the actual conversation. So they can take me to other conversations, which alter my sense of who I am and what the candle is and how the world is. So what we're looking at, this is the Thomas Traherne, the great 17th century mystic, talks about the universe as the shady nothing. And if you ever read Thomas Traherne, he's perceiving the earth. I'll take out one of his quotes a little later, I'm sure I've used them before, but where his sense of the human being the soul, each human being the sole heir of the universe. So that the oceans are in your blood, so the mountains are in your bones. So that the winds of heaven will come in and out of your lungs. So this is the sense really of the deep conversation that happens all the time. So when we're present in this way, what happens is we interrupt the habitual conversation. So here we come back to psychology. When you see small children interacting with the world, their fluidity, their imaginative fluidity, they're entering into these conversations all the time. Because their fluidity, their creativity is not occluded. But what happens to us through the events of really from in the womb onwards, really from the, because what happens if we think about incarnation as a shaping process? So if we think of the human being as this composite being that comes out of, if you like, the presence of the soul coming into incarnate existence, coming out of the generative mystery, out of the mysterious place that the soul inhabits, which is sort of timeless and beyond space. But so if we think of what happens in the moment of incarnation, which is the coming together of the sperm and the egg with the incarnating consciousness. So this is the beginning of the composite human being that each of us are. And is the kind of the root, the beginning of this, but not the beginning of our souls, but the beginning of this iteration, this aspect of our soul in incarnation. So we come together, we enter from the formless realms of light, we could say, into a woman's body, the body of our mothers. So in a certain sense, they were somewhere in the fallopian tube when this happens. So there's this moment of extraordinary moment, when the fertile egg is available, and this great vast surge of sperm, hundreds of them. I don't know how many. I can't even.
Millions.
Well, yeah, extraordinary, vast, great horde of swimmers, all kind of doing that. Hey, okay, here we go. They're tiny, and the movement between, and of course the egg is massive compared to the sperm. So these tiny little swimmers. Here we go. And all are going to die but one. And that's going to die because it's going to transform into something else. So you get this moment, really, this extraordinary moment of kind of impregnation of the unity, really, between the egg and the sperm, and the descent of the third principle, the incarnating consciousness. So we get this explosion, really, that like the reflection within the human being of the creation of the universe. Because what comes into being is a new universe in that moment. And what we then, and then of course what happens in that moment, this weaving together of threads. So that Egyptian idea of the singular reed that is us, that has come out of the shining place, that is held in this, cupped in this weaving together, is in some ways a very good description of what happens in that moment of conjunction, in that moment of ignition between the egg and the sperm, because it's the, if you like, the genetic material of the mother and the father and their ancestral histories are woven together with the soul history and the transcendental intention of the soul, bringing with it whatever it brings in, to create this composite being. That is the new being, who then has to make this extraordinary journey down the fallopian tube, and it's like to the womb, which is this holy place, right? So it has to make this enormous journey into this kind of vast cathedral-like space, you could say. But it and then it has to find, and it's sustaining itself at this point because of its internal resources. But it by the time it does come into the vast fluid filled space of the womb, it's at the end of its resources. It has to come more deeply. Already having come into incarnation, it has to come into direct relationship with the sense of the with the mother. It has to implant itself into the womb lining. It then has to draw sustenance, life, energy from the mother in order to shape and create itself. It has to, and all the and this, in this whole kind of movement, the singular cell is multiplying itself. It doubles itself. It quadruples itself. It multiplies itself. It turns into the embryonic disc. So it becomes a sort of from a singularity. It becomes a like a two-dimensional being, a disc, and then it does this amazing flip, where it becomes a globe, and it sort of turns inside out. So all of it, and it's, you know, that place where we all, if we touch your belly button for a moment, you know, this is the place of connection, really, and then there's this whole process of what arises, so the globe acquires an axis. It becomes a three-chambered being. And it acquires buds, it acquires limbs, it acquires sense organs, it grows, it takes shape in this extraordinary kind of place that it eventually outgrows. And as it outgrows, there's a whole process then that happens, another process of transition that happens in the triggering of birth and the whole process of. Now this is all, you know, coming back to this whole kind of process of perception and creation. So the creation of the becoming the composite being. Because we are literally, we come into relationship through our sense of mother. We come into sense, the mother is the mediator between us at this stage and the rest of the world. But as we know from studies, you know, fetuses are conscious in the womb. They perceive the womb. They hear sounds. They experience pressure. They certainly experience the inner state of the mother. And so they experience the world as mediated through the experience of the mother. And they react accordingly. We all have reacted accordingly to that. Now all of that creates, from that very beginning, and creates the basis of our, if you like, our conversation with the universe as we're now experiencing it. And if you imagine the power, the potency of these events right at the beginning of our life, in this, where we're dealing with these fundamental forces of creation, depending on how it is for our mothers, how it is for the world around our mothers. And this is not to make mothers responsible for this, because it's really about the way the world around our mothers impacts their consciousness and how we share in that consciousness. So if I think of my own experience, really, which was this, my mother had been was very unhappy when I was in the room. Her parents had died. She was a very young mum. Well, no, she was not young, in her 20s. But she was, basically she had, her parents died and she had to give up her career as a nurse to look after her brothers and sisters. She did that. My dad moved in, and they got married, and they both looked after them. And when the brothers and sisters got old enough, they threw my mum and dad out. And so she felt very betrayed by her family. And the only place they could find to live, because they didn't have much money, was a house next door to my grandmother, who hated her. And also, the village, my mother was English speaking and lived in the valley in a place called Clydach. The village she moved to was very Welsh speaking, and with a huge prejudice against English speaking Welsh people. So my mother was very isolated and very depressed and very kind of, and very angry, and I think felt very trapped by having become pregnant. I mean, I wasn't a planned pregnancy. It was a product of some gone-off spermicidal jelly, I believe, was the story. It was nice enough to share that. I mean, how did I come to be? You know, did I come to be? Oh, we think the jelly went off. All right. Oh, good. But we were pleased. Oh, all right, okay. Yeah, well, yeah, that is because you're dead. Why aren't you like anybody else in the family? And, yeah, there's a whole other thing that will go there. But certainly about my very early experience in the room, it was being overwhelmed by my mother's depression. And there's good reasons for it, it's not her fault. But one of the pieces of, and I'm not saying this was not a conscious process, I'm talking about it now because I've tapped into these levels and I'm describing it as in a way that we can all understand. But so one of my ways of trying to help my mother was to try and draw as little as possible life force from her and to somehow help her to keep going. Just on the physical things that then happened, interesting. I was a premature and very underweight baby, and actually and wouldn't feed. So part of my own kind of deep conversations is to try to be self-reliant, to try and not to draw from others, to help others, but not to receive. And that's sort of in my bones somewhere. And, you know, and there's a whole, you know, so it goes on. There's a whole, you know, set of processes that follow on from that. Now, all of that, we all have, of course, our own version of that kind of conversation, which isn't perceived by us as a conversation. It's perceived, until we pay attention, it's perceived of this is who I am and this is how the world is. So this sense of, because what gets created is a sense of embedded identity of me and the universe. And we need that because we need stability. We're not at a stage where the thing about, if you think about small children who are very, very fluid, but what they also really need is stability. You need safety, you need to, you know, that little great thing where you see toddlers, where they've got the invisible kind of connection to the mother, where they can go so far and then then have to run back, you know, because that's then the need for solidity and stability, remains. And so that very early kind of conversation becomes the building blocks for the rest of the conversations we have about, and because we live in a culture that is that certainly from the 18th century onwards has seen the world as not as a series of animated conversations, but as things that you manipulate, solid things that you measure, that you weigh, that you shape, that you buy, that you sell. There's nothing in our culture that says, hang on a minute, there's a different way to perceive things. And this is why the importance of people like Coleridge or the poets or the mystics who say, hang on a minute, reality is actually quite different from that, you know. Reality, you know, if we slow ourselves down, and if we slow down, because the problem we have is that the internal dialogue is so fast, it's not perceived as a dialogue. when you slow yourself down through meditation or life circumstances, or just because you're somewhere nice in nature, well, as that dialogue starts to slow down, this primal ability just to perceive and then to enter into conversation starts to come online. Because it's the fundamental thing. So as we then start to experience ourselves as a witnessing being in conversation with other living beings, then something different and interesting starts to happen. We're drawn, of course, back, of course, into the old dialogue all the time because it's got momentum. But there's the possibility now of a new dialogue emerging. And that new dialogue comes out of the primary act of perception and conversation. And then what Coleridge describes as the secondary imagination, which are the living images, which are the appearance of icons that act as seeds within us, that start to alter the momentum and the direction of the older kind of dialogue, to bring us into a more expanded sense of ourselves. And that's why, you know, when we look at these old stories, what we're doing is not for the sake of learning old stories, and because you can use these stories to bolster up your sense of self and make you more and more kind of feel powerful and feel safer, but more to enter into that sense of mystery, so that our deeper sense of nature is revealed to us. So we become the beings who can talk with giants, not as some big, you know, ridiculous sort of thing, but as by slowing down enough, by there being these fluid beings who are bridging everything, we can find ourselves just coming down, coming down, coming down, coming down into that slowness, into that deepness, into that movement underneath. So we can touch that presence of Gog Magog, who is thrown into the deep sea. You know, if you think, now what's helpful about these mythical stories is they give us images, they give us hints. So Gog Magog is not dead. Gog Magog is not is this figure who is thrown into the deep. So if we can go down into the deep, we will touch and experience what is meant by Gog Magog. And a particularly interesting thing about that is that one of the aspects of that particular story, right, because that's why the history of the Kings of Britain is interesting, and its connection with the Trojan War is interesting, and it often doesn't get picked up by people. Where the Trojan War is all about conflicts that need not have happened, and are delusional and kind of and mad and crazy, and what you see is the Trojans and Brutus, instead of coming into the land and making friends with the giants. You don't see any place where they think, I should make friends with the giants. We're taking possession, we're seizing it, we're, it's going to be ours, or get lost, giants. And so there's this, Corineus has this great struggle with the last remaining giant and throws him off into the deep. Can't get rid of him because he's, can't kill him because he can wound him, but he can't get rid of him because he's one of the fundamental energies. Now, so when we allow ourselves to sink into the deep, sink underneath, and touch what is meant by the consciousness of Gog Magog, if we can do that in such a way that is relational, that is not about dominating, and not about being frightened, and not about, and actually is about, if you like, righting an ancient wrong. And in a certain sense, if you think of the Britons as the inheritors, the inheritors, the descendants of the Trojans, then you see that you know, part of what the Trojans bring with them is a deep connection to the great goddess energies, but also they bring with them a sense of defeat and rage and kind of and a desire to rebuild Troy and have it as their own and defend it at all costs. Now, it's just interesting that is something that continually recurs within the collective British psyche. Yeah, and so there's all kinds of layers. We could explore all kinds of layers of this. There's all layers of history in it where we will see where we can see how this happens. But right at the root of it, so where the history of the Kings of Britain is pointing us, is this is there something fundamental that's happened about our relationship to the deep? And if we start creating a different relationship between ourselves and the giants. First of all, one of the things that's really helpful about doing that is we get a sense of that you're having a giant as a friend is quite handy. Right? Because actually that enormous strength, that enormous stability. But what you also know, if you look at the folklore stories about giants, you've got to be careful. They get it wrong a lot because they're operating at such a different scale. And they've got all these folklore stories where giants accidentally destroy things. And they, oh, sorry. Because their energies are so vast, they can't operate. So you have to be careful. You have to have filters. You have to really touch that gigantic energy and hang out with it. And then the art of creating conversation in some ways is the art of connecting, creating a resonance between yourself and the other that works. You create a common language, and it's really like when you talk with somebody and you don't have a language in common. What you do, you use gesture, you point, you create, and then you exchange words, and you say that word means this to me, and they know this means that to you. And what you start to see is then a matching starting to happen, whereby you both then start to understand each other, and you know that great moment where you start. But first of all, you can't understand each other at all. And then suddenly you stumble on something. As you always do with people. You stumble on something and you both feel really happy because you stumble on words that you understand. You're starting to get it with each other. So this is similar. This is a real kind of similar thing where you're creating a kind of a language that works, and then and as that develops little by little, it's obviously very slow, we're talking about these vast ancient energies, you then start to befriend and they befriend you, you befriend them, and your sense of identity is enlarged because you're at one level, oh, I've got a titan is one of my friends, Gog Magog is one of my friends. One of my friends, and his influence, his her influence, we don't really know what sex there is, felt in my life, and I contribute something to the life of what is represented by God Magog. And the art in a way is then the continuing of that conversation, because as we work in that way, that sense of changed identity, because we start to come into then more and more our sense of being the living bridge, right? This is a soul, these things, who would be the head, who would be the generative center, must be the living bridge. So the human being becomes the living bridge that connects together all these different possibilities, the all and the small, the particular and the universal. So we enter into a kind of a deepening sense of self. And in that way, we become the center of a new conversation. We find it very powerfully in the writings of Thomas Traherne. They're not easy writing, 17th century poetry, but where he is describing a world where the universal and the particular are together. So he's describing just as a rector of a village walking around, and you're seeing people just doing, making hay, bringing in the crops. And he's talking about perceiving cherubim. and seeing gold in the streets. And these are his words for describing the numinosity that happens as that kind of deep kind of conversation is manifesting through him. And his sense really of the universe as this kind of shady, it's a lovely phrase, the shady nothing that keeps shifting and presenting itself through different aspects and modes of the conversation. Now this is what, you know, Coleridge is trying to describe for us when he talks about these different aspects of the primary imagination, the secondary imagination, but the third piece that we have to kind of look at all the time is the this quality he calls fancy. Now fancy is based upon the historic internal dialogue that is associative. So it takes us away from the primary experience of perception and the secondary kind of images that are generated from that into it takes us away from that moment of presence into my sense of my historical sense of me and my world, which isn't just a cognitive sense. It actually has its own energetic energetic kind of shape to it. So it has the spinning wheel. It's absolutely the spinning wheel, and it's like a vortex that takes us into a more limited sense of self and a more limited sense of the universe. And because of that, we our ability to perceive becomes, we get cut off from our direct ability to perceive. But we can then only perceive through filters. And that's why very often when you're caught in that, you just to stop, go for a walk, do something physical, kind of know that we're in that, so that, because what with the spinning wheel, we have to then, the first thing to do is to know we're in it, not to fight it, because the more you fight it, the stronger it gets. And just to use the physicality, the anchoring nature of our body, to bring ourselves back into the moment. And gradually what happens, that starts to slow down again. Our senses start to open again in a different way. And this capacity that the body has is to be like the Roman god Janus, to point in both directions. Our senses point us inner and outer, then starts to locate us back in the conversation where we left it. So that's the kind of answer. That was an answer to the question. Perhaps a bit more than you might have hoped for. Yeah? Yeah, go on. Hello.
It was slightly to the side of that. When we create things, like, you know, there's a place of making of.
Yes.
It could be right, you know,
yes.
The creation.
Yes.
Okay, so where does that come from?
That comes out of the secondary imagination, okay. Right? So that's the thing. So that's the image. These are these images. When I talk about the thing about the icon and the idol, so the all that has to do with intention. When we're working from that purely creative place, it comes out of the creative dialogue. So we shape. So like Faye's mermaid, you know, she's not made that to impress us. She's made it because it's come out of the. Come out. Now, if we were making something because we want to flog it to somebody for a lot of money, that's probably coming from a different, much more conditioned part of ourselves. But when we make something or paint something or write something or write a poem or a kind of a, or make a scientific discovery, that's coming out of that deeper creative. And that then becomes an icon, a creative image that connects other people. So this collaboration between us all. So then these become the icons that remind us all of our true relationship with the universe. And that's as true as the works of science as it is of the arts. So the people who discovered quantum theory discovered this amazing set of ideas that connect us to, if you read something like Carlo Rovelli, you know, who you might, who's a scientist. He, his images, his ideas connect us to that, that creative sense of the universe. The person who created the image of King Arthur there, which you find on Tintagel Head, which is this extraordinary image of he's there and he's not there. And then you, when you look at the actual image out on the Tintagel, if you look through him at different places, you look one way, you see the land through him. You look another way, you see the sea through him, and space through him. And so all these things then are powerful images that, as we engage with them, take us back to this fundamental dialogue of creativity and awareness. As opposed to, if you think of images that are like propaganda, now what they're intended to do is to suck us into a dialogue that takes our creativity and our energy and harnesses it for the purpose of those who are pushing out the propagandized image. So the choice always is about, can we remain in contact with ourselves and our primary kind of energies of perception? Or do we get lost either in our own collective, our own dialogue, or lost in some version of the collective dialogue that imprisons us? And that's why a lot of the old stories have a lot to do with imprisonment and freedom. So in the story of Brutus, the story begins with a kind of a sense of defeat and loss and brokenness and pain and trauma, we would say, as a therapist. And as he starts to free himself up from that, he next encounters the descendants of the Trojans who were in slavery, who he also frees. And then he has this sense of lostness. So he starts to connect then to the deeper energies of the universe by going to the island with the, and he has to make a choice between the gods, between the Jupiter, between Mercury, and between the goddess Diana. And then by choosing the goddess, which is the deep root in a sense of the Trojans, and wrapping himself in the skin of the white stag, he enters into a kind of a dreaming place that recreates that creates a new dialogue, which brings him to the island of Britain. So in a sense, that's, you know, in a way, that's where. So when Geoffrey writes his book, he's writing a book of magical images, both this and the Vita Mellini, which he sends through time as a message to us to say, if you look at these images, if you let yourself enter into these images, they will free you from your whatever conditions are imprisoning you. They will take you into the place of whatever woundedness, whatever pain and difficulty entraps you, and will take you to the island paradise.
So is that why we get attracted to particular, whether it's giants or angels or,
yes,
or pixies?
Yes.
It's because there's something that wants to unravel him,
the whole point is a particular resonance, a particular sympathy with a particular form.
And that it's pulling you.
Yes, it pulls you. That's the conversation, right? It pulls you. You notice your attention being pulled. You notice your attention being attracted to something. And, there's so many possibilities, right? But actually something particular draws your attention. So it could be a pixie. Mm. It could be, and it literally can be anything. You know those little Joan the Wad pixie things you get in Cornwall sometimes? Mm. Now, it's easy to say, oh, they're just silly. But if your attention was attracted by that little tourist gigo, and you just pay attention to Joan the Wad, and as you enter into that conversation, you'll enter into the pixie realm, the fairy realm, the realm of Spriggans, you then start to ultimately come to something where Joan the Wad is this cosmic kind of figure. a doorway into the infinite that's speaking back to you.
Is it true of plants and
yes,
trees
every,
and
true of everything. Platform. It's absolutely true of everything, right? So everything that we enter into, with made objects. Well, if you look at that lamp over there, I've been looking at the candle. You do that with the lamp. You enter into the sense of electricity and that kind of, you know. So anything is a potential doorway. Now, we can't literally be in conversation with everything. Our minds aren't and our hearts aren't built for that. So what happens is, what you find is that we have a particular resonances with particular things that draw us. So we get drawn to particular myth patterns, or we get drawn to particular stories, particular aspects of the landscape, and that they become our go-to places that really help us enter into this deeper place. And every now and again, these things shift or transform depending upon the way that our life unfolds and the way that our particular needs change. You know, so that the, you know, so for example, you know, if we were Tibetans, we would be not talking about Arthur. We will be talking about a king called Geza, who is the Tibetan Arthur. And we will be talking about, a great, instead of Merlin, we will be talking about Padmasambhava, who is the great master of magic in Tibetan magic. You know, so that we follow our sense of sympathy, our sense of sympathetic echo, that brings us in more and more deeply into the mysterious conversation.
I think there's something really, really fascinating that you've mentioned, that place in Paralandra when the angel, you know, what form.
Yeah.
And there's also distance.
Yeah.
And this is like, that's the right
distance. The right distance.
Now I
yes.
can perceive you.
That's right.
And so even as you're then tracking with the candle, it always yeah. feels to me like, where is the place where the
yeah.
consciousness of the candle, the consciousness of me, how am I held in it? So there's the directions
yeah.
and
yeah.
that vertical and
yeah.
horizontal axis. And at some point, the two vertical axes connect.
Yes, that's
and
right.
that can be like Joe in the Ward, can be very close to, oh, this is like a cute little thing.
Yeah.
But then gradually,
yeah.
it begins to
yeah,
move.
Exactly.
And that becomes a vertical
yes,
axis.
That's right.
So my horizontal axis, connected through the vertical, has suddenly created a third
yes.
connection.
That's right.
And that third connection connects everywhere.
Yes.
Well, if it's more, so this is, I mean, I'm very visual, so this is the way I understand it from what you're saying. But if I'm in that secondary imagination place, if I'm writing, if I'm weaving, spinning, creating, then actually, it's at the vertical axis in its bigness, and it's connecting all out here to all of that potential.
Yeah.
It's not like there's a meeting point that is outside myself. And I kind of think of that as that magical meeting point,
yeah.
the place of all potential in that, in those two consciousnesses coming together
yeah.
to inspire something far greater in that place of conversation.
Yeah.
And so then the central place of how am I held in my own verticality, what is the potential of the horizontal through that verticality, becomes the place that I'm responsible for.
Yeah. Now, and when you're writing that, as you say, it's a different thing, because that energy then is coming out through you
yeah.
and you're shaping the thing that then will become, which of course is then the thing you start dialoguing with, any piece of writing, anything you make, then it comes into being, and then you have to start dialoguing with it, very annoyingly, until it gets itself right. And in a certain sense, there's always that interesting piece when you've really completed a creative piece of work, whether it's a pot or an image or a painting or a book or a poem. There's a moment when it's complete, when the link snaps, and it's its own thing.
Mm. Then it's hard to remember how you did it sometimes.
Yeah, completely. Yeah, totally.
Poetry,
I mean,
yeah.
Did I write that?
Yeah.
No, completely. No, totally. It's absolutely the same with books. So I look at some of my books sometimes and think, oh, did I write? I have no idea how I wrote that.
Yeah.
You know, it's
we might have to ask you, have you got through the deadline business yet?
Well, I got over the hump because I had a writing week to do that. And I am going to make my deadline, but I'm going to have to work hard. I am going to have to work quite hard to do it because I'm up against time, really. So, yes, I got through it. So I just needed a week to do nothing but write tonight. A couple of very difficult pieces of writing I had to do, but I managed to do it. And so now I just got to work hard next 6 weeks or something.
Just get back to these vertical axes which are proliferating alarmingly and just say, is it a helpful, I would think that would be a helpful structure to put that in a Venn diagram? You know, a sort of a 3D Venn diagram. Would you agree with that? Because it's just my way of then, you know, you've got your two things and then the intersection, which is where you have the dialogue, and which can fluctuate, obviously, can't it? So is that what you're saying, but in a different way, do you think? I mean, if we imagine in each part of the Venn diagram, there's a vertical axis, because it's what you did.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'd say that for me, though, that vertical axis has its own consciousness now, so you need a whole new Venn diagram for that. So if I...
Oh, yeah, yeah.
They're not static, they're living beings in themselves because of the energy that has come together to create them, which
yes.
itself is tapped into that
yeah.
great web of life or imprisonment or whatever. So the Venn diagram tracks more linearly, and this is spherical and complete and always got, like, what's created in that third
axis
is unlimited at that point.
Yeah.
And it's
yes.
this conversation
yes.
that defines it into more of its
particularity.
Manifest or particularity. Yeah.
Yes.
So I couldn't turn that into a Venn diagram.
No, because it would be like...
Yeah.
Living.
Yes.
Living, and it would be like three-dimensional kind of living geometry or something.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Which is,
yeah.
yeah. Mm.
And then I'll pass out.
Yeah. yeah. Well, I couldn't do that either. My mind could not contain that.
Do you remember going to bed as a child and thinking, so there's space and you put a cardboard box around that, but then there's space beyond that, and so there's a bigger cardboard box, and you just fall asleep at
the cardboard box is all the way, isn't it? I had a strange...
Why cardboard?
It was a life-changing moment, really. But 10 years ago, I was playing frisbee with a friend of mine in a beautiful, beautiful idyllic garden that we were staying down in Devon, digging down in Devon. And I suppose what happened to me changed the way I understood the conversation. Because I was playing with my mate Daz, back and forth. I play a lot of frisbee. We play frisbee a lot, me and my friends. And just back and forth, you know, nothing clever. And out of the corner of my eye, really hard to explain, and it's out, but it's absolutely concrete in terms of what I experienced, and I don't doubt it at all, but I never actually saw it because I was watching the frisbee. But something in a flower bed, probably no further than that little carpet there, was watching. And it was all kind of out of time, I suppose, because it all happened so quickly, but it seemed very gradual thing. That as I was playing frisbee, I could see it, and I wanted to look. And as the frisbee was coming towards me, I was sort of watching the frisbee, but I saw it. Let's call it a gnome, because that's what I've always called it. This garden, real garden gnome, so to speak, was watching us playing frisbee, and it was fascinating to it. And as the frisbee came towards me and I was about to turn, it noticed that I was going to look, and it knew it had to disappear, but it kind of dragged its feet.
Yeah,
and it was sort of going, like, it waited to the very last millisecond.
Yeah.
And as I caught it and I looked, it was gone. And it was like, okay, so I've got... It isn't just like me mystically trying to understand, you know, the etheric realm and all this stuff, which I've had a few experiences of that beforehand, but this was something else. This was like playing frisbee, playing a very human thing, and this little being
was fascinated. I'd probably been watching for ages, and then I finally noticed. I was like, oh, I better go. But it was like really kind of reluctant to leave.
So if you let yourself remember the Noam now, and just connect to the Noam. Just without any expectation, just see what happens. No, stay with it.
It's big.
Just stay with it. So you're not just remembering it, you're noticing it. You're noticing it and it's noticing you. And just see what happens.
Put it earlier when you said you're talking to someone and you find a thing you both settle on, like, we both understand that. I think our love of frisbee and being the Noam.
Okay. So stay with that sense of you and the Noam enjoying the feeling of frisbee. So not going off into frisbee, but you and the Noam enjoying frisbee. So let that love of frisbee connect you to the Noam. Just know that feeling. Mm-hmm. So notice the Noam, what happens to the Noam as you more fully connect with that.
It doesn't suddenly become a gnome.
No.
But there's a sort of a white outline that becomes more bright.
Good. So just not making anything happen here. Just again stay in touch with what's happening. Following the dialogue. So it becomes brighter. Your attention gets more drawn towards it. And just see what happens. Don't put your finger on anything. just notice. Does the outline stay? Does it get brighter, dimmer? What's the subtle feeling?
It's an emotional feeling.
Good.
It's a joy.
Right. Good.
A shared joy.
Shared joy. So be with that shared joy. You and the Noam. Just here now. You connecting to the Noam. Noam connecting with you through your shared joy of frisbee.
takes me wider into the into where I was. Just north of Los Mayo and Newton Ferris.
So the gnome is showing you something?
Yeah, showing me the land.
Okay. So keep aware of the gnome, you and the gnome, it's the primary perception. And just together look at the land.
As we look together, it sort of kind of diffuses out in a circle around a particularly beautiful part of the world. Yeah, it's cool. Yeah, it's a, but there's definitely a two-way feeling of, you know, it isn't. So often it's us looking at things and wondering, but this was an interest back.
Yeah, well, it's the two of you looking together.
Yeah,
right,
it's quite a beautiful thing.
Okay. So it's really important to get your living connection with the gnome. And the gnome is showing you his home. Equally, if you want to, you can show the gnome your home. Maybe just before we finish, just show the gnome where you live.
Heidi was convinced there was a gnome in my back garden.
Hmm?
Heidi was convinced there was a gnome
in your back garden.
Back garden.
Good. So what?
And that gnome's just come to me now.
Okay, so
I've never met the gnome.
So as you showed the gnome your home just then, what happened?
Immediately was reminded of.
So you're reminded of Heidi, good.
Heidi saying there's a gnome
in that garden. So come back to the gnome, see what the gnome is doing as he's invited in to your home.
Showed it where I play frisbee, where I live.
Yeah.
You know,
Great.
Just a general sense of, this is what you do.
Yeah, great.
Such a big and strange thing.
Really important to get the living connection between you and the gnome. You know, and how you connect, and you can continue, obviously it's up to you what you want to do, but then you can continue the dialogue with the gnome and get to know each other. He can show you his house, you can show him yours.
Mm.
You can discover what you can learn from each other.
And then next time I go to the rap league where I play frisbee with my friend, another friend, I will have that gnome
pretty sure he'll be there.
He'll be there. Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Usually, whatever, doesn't matter. But when you go home tonight, sit down and invite the gnome in when you're sitting down in your at home after the day's ended. Just not that's been very long, just spend a few minutes just inviting him in and just seeing, just communicating together for a little bit. Beautiful.
Wonderful.
Wonderful. Thank you, Phil. That's lovely. No, that's great. About 10 minutes left before lunch. So this is see if there's anything else that's on people's minds just before we go off for lunch. Yeah.
When you talk about Gog and Magog, so I used to, before I had Blossom, go out regularly and connect with all the spirit beings.
Yeah.
And I had one with Gog and Magog, which was very strong, and I didn't realise it was like connecting with the giants.
That's interesting.
Good. And I've got the little thing that it said. So I felt the tree was really deeply rooted and connected to the earth. And like it was this bridge between the worlds.
We just tell people, may not know. Gog and Magog, there are two very old oak trees in Glastonbury. One of which is dead, the other is still alive.
Yes, yeah, so Gog is dead and Magog.
But they become known as Gog and Magog, right? So that's what Faye's talking about, communing with the trees.
Yeah. Yeah. So for me, Gog had kind of withdrawn its energy and I couldn't connect with Gog. So Magog felt this bridge between the worlds, balancing these opposing forces, keeping them in balance, like the masculine and the feminine, yin yang, dark and light. And it felt like there was the trees were completely vital to keep this balance energetically for our survival, and not just in the physical, but there was something much deeper and stronger going on, which I didn't really understand. Then I kind of got this sense of Magog and heard it, this really deep, echoey voice. And it was, I am Magog, I have been here for many hundreds of your years, but I don't experience time as you do. I am forever in the moment of being, so I have always been and always will be. This is just a moment of time, a moment in your time. And then I asked if this was a message for me or humanity, and I just got this, I am being, in this really loud, strong voice. And it felt like it echoed with this huge power through the whole galaxy. And I had this sense that it was connected to the centre of the earth and the heavens above, like this conductor of energy. And then it also felt, it sort of reminded me of a guru in a cave like Maharishi, who just sits in silence in this deep meditation, like holding this energy.
It's got that fundamental titanic kind of quality to it, isn't it? Expressed through the experience of the tree.
Speaking to my mother, I don't do that so much. I think I should get back to it.
Might be good to do that when you have the time. Your little girl takes a lot of time and energy.
Yeah.
However,
not so little now.
Not so little, no. Indeed.
When I was 4 years ago, when I was on Mount Etna, went up as far as you're allowed to go, and I know, you know, the rational part of me says it was lack of oxygen, because the wind was blowing so hard you were sort of having to bite the oxygen to get the fresh air. But I had this real sense of this absolute immensity of being.
Yeah.
And then I don't hate this word, but I'm going to say it, downloaded, seemed to be out all this strange mixture of Latin and Arabic all went in it. Mm. And the whole time we were there, where we were staying, I could see Mount Etna, and I felt that connection all the time. I tried to translate this stuff that I'd written down, but it didn't make a tremendous amount of sense. But what you were saying about how you've got to learn the language, and I've let that connection go, and I'm just wondering, perhaps I should start working with that connection again.
Yeah,
and it's just that feeling of huge expansiveness, that's just very big. I sort of say Etna was theoretically the home of the Smith god.
Yeah, it was.
So something to do with that as well.
It's also connected to a figure called Empedocles, who was a great kind of another of the pre-Socratic philosophers and great teachers, really. So Empedocles ends his life by unifying with Etna. He dives into Etna.
Wow.
And he is the person that creates the concept of the four elements. In that, right at the beginning, because this is way back, in Homeric times. So he, the other philosophers had looked at the elements, but he first creates the idea that the elements are fourfold, fire, and he calls them the roots, and the sort of fire, air, earth, and water as the roots of everything. So and he works with underneath the roots. He says there are these two images. There's the image of strife and love, and strife is the energy that enables things to be separate and bounded, and love is the energy that brings things together. Mm-hmm. And working with the right balance of strife and love, and the way that's reflected in the four elements, is the way you bring the universe into balance, emphatically, sort of said.
It's interesting that it was in Latin and Arabic. Almost like people who talked to it before.
Sicily is full of that. These are the two strong Arabic connections, of course, strong Latin connection.
It seemed to be saying all the time something about that I was here and they used to notice me, but they don't notice me anymore.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. That's very right. That would be right, actually. Absolutely. Yeah. Powerful.
And you want to be noticed again?
Hmm?
And you want to be noticed again?
I don't necessarily want to be noticed, though, but I just
done something. I'm sorry, I think I misunderstood what you said. I hope you get that.
Well, it's the mountain that wants to be noticed.
No, the mountain wants to be noticed.
The mountain wants to be noticed. Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
Seems something alive, as opposed to something being contained and worried about all the time.
Yes. Mm. Mm. So that's the different approach. Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, it never stops.
Yeah. No. So that would be the interesting thing to see what happens.
Very like American gods, isn't it? You have to worship the god to keep it alive.
Yeah.
Quite like the Egyptian invocation at the tomb, requiring people to do something in order that the gods may live, the culture may live.
So Penny's talking about Paddy Aminope's tomb in the Valley of the Kings, where it's extraordinary. It's the biggest tomb in the Valley of the Kings, but there's an extraordinary inscription in it that says, you who visit this place for pleasure and instruction in later years, give praise to the great God that which has been destroyed may live again. And it's that, again, it's the, you know, the praise really is a conversation, it's the communion, the dialogue between the you know, it's like the deep and the surface between us and the universal.
There are some situations, I think, when I'm thinking about how Native Americans, the First Peoples, make contact. There are certain big energies or like really powerful beings that they, it's like almost wrong to invoke them. They have to invoke you.
You, yeah, that's absolutely true, yeah. No, I think there's something absolutely spot on about this, because if we think that there are seven places, so in the sense what Linda's describing, is the Etna making contact with you. And so we, like, well, so do I fancy being connecting to a big powerful energy like Etna, or some giant energy, I fancy doing that. But of course that's the way to get squished, no, because that, cause there's something about letting the, as these deeper energies approach us, then we respond, and that they initiate the initiate the dialogue. And
do you not think in some way that we do still initiate it, because it is set up by our respectful, yeah, engaging aspect to the thing, which you might have had in 1,000 tourists didn't.
No, I absolutely do think that. I think our availability that I'm noticing in a certain sense. I think what Holly's talking about is that place where people will, you know, through prayer or invocation, try and summon that, yeah, kind of an energy into being. And I think that's, and I think that goes for the angels. You know, my own relationship with the angels is always an invitation. It's not a sort of making the angels appear. You know, they have been companions of mine for many years, and I, you know, you know, so I think of, you know, I'm not summoning into being, I'm inviting them to be here.
It's like a reverence, you know, like, say, yeah, like they're going to the tree, yeah, having reverence for the mountain and having reverence for it. Yeah. Might not have kind of gone, I'm going to have reverence, but you sort of just have it.
Have it, exactly.
And
yeah,
then it can, yeah, respond to that.
Yeah.
It's sort of a different thing to kind of go, or like, let's sort of tune into this energy because we want to feel its power or something.
Yes, yeah, so, well, that's manipulative, isn't it? That's not relational when you do that. In a sense, I want what you've got.
Yeah, it's not a conversation.
It's not a conversation. No, and it doesn't have that respect, a mutual sense of respect, really, that you have in a co-creational conversation.
There's something so interesting about how everything brings something different, a different combination. And you know, they say how we're all in the different cells of the world and we're all different. And but then today I've just been so much with everybody in the room, and it's like we all come from just a slightly different perspective,
yeah,
and you know, yes, different aspects of our humanity are used, and
yes, exactly. Yeah.
And then what really came strongly to me was when you were talking, and while I don't relate to goblins, it the pixies in me just were like. So something about the recognition of. I don't know what it is, but it was so nice.
No, I was thinking about you, the pixies and the wood, really, because that's such a strong thing as you connect.
Yes.
Yeah.
So is it something that's intrinsic, you know, like on the soul level, or is it something that we're being invited into to explore more, or
it
could be both?
Well, I think it's both, isn't it? So it's obviously we come with our own identity, the soul identity that comes into. So if we think that we come into, as we were saying earlier, we come into a particular family, a particular shape, but we also come into a particular land and a particular way of mediating between the the inner and the outer. And then from that land, we visit places like Linda visiting Etna, or thinking off to Egypt, or, you know, so we create so we have a sense of connection. So we think of it as a web of connections that we create. Some connections are very ephemeral, and others are more substantial. And even if, so, you know, and sometimes we can go places and have a connection. We may even go there once, but the connection really remains because there's something kind of mysterious there. And it's like out of the infinite possibility of connections, what you tend to find is a number of connections that feel like intrinsically yours, and that are so for me, the archangels are a set of connections that are not my only connections by any means, but they're a fundamental set of connections that align me to the inner worlds, and they keep me connected and align, and from that other connections develop. And I think that's, you know, we've all got that. We've all got our own sense of these are the things that connect to us. So that sense of, you know, that, you know, just because you and I know each other quite well, your sense of connection to Sulis, your sense of connection to Pixies, the kind of work you do around sound and working with sound and nature and owls. You know, so there's a whole set of things really that are your connections that over time, of course, expand and develop and grow. You know, and it's sort of, and like I say, we've all got that. You know, sort of, and he has all kinds of things going on in a set of connections, including a connection to an enormously potent Indian guru. You know, and Nisargadatta Maharaj is one of inner connections. The free Christ is another one of your connections. You know, but we've all got that. You know, and these are the beings when we lean into them, and some will be more prominent sometimes in our lives than others. But they guide or help us guide our ongoing conversation with the universe. Right, let's have a break for our lunch.
There was a point this morning, later on in the morning, I thought, no, I don't want this, don't let's stop the lunch. We just keep going.